This is Greg Bond with the UW Oral History Program. It is October 1st, 2012, our third interview with Lewis Richardson. I'm in the office in Madison. Lewis is at his home in Fort Worth, Texas. And as I mentioned to Lewis before we started recording, I had a couple follow-up questions from our last interview. In looking back through some of the old newspaper articles I found about the incidents in 1968, I noticed that groups of the black players met with the athletic board a couple times. I was wondering if you had any memories about that, if the athletic board was more supportive than perhaps some people in the athletic department were.
Let me see if I recall any of that.
Okay.
I can't remember how many people were in on that.
Mm-hmm.
There were how many people on the athletic board a part of that.
Sure.
I know I was there, I guess, Mel Reddick, Father John Smith. I'm trying to think of what other guys might have been in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't remember if the whole group of us went or just a few representatives. But anyway, they did some. It was probably one reason that type of did was because of the things that had been going on or the things that happened. I can't remember. Did this happen before the banquet incident or after?
After, I think. Once it became public, there were a couple of the, I don't know if they're regularly scheduled meetings, but the athletic board got together to meet with, it looks like, representatives from some of the black players and also representatives from the white players to try to figure out what was going on and how they could, if they could help things out at all.
I don't know if anything significant came out of that. It was kind of like they would do whatever they could,
mm-hmm,
create some sensitivity,
sure,
among the people, mm-hmm, there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess as a result of the banquet thing, the damage had been done. Now it's, I guess, time to try to correct it, improve it, whatever,
sure,
you want to, you know, whatever kind of spin you want to put on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Let me ask this, because you probably remember, or you probably had it down somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Did I make my statement with my daddy that time about it wouldn't be corrected before that meeting or after?
No, that was about a year later, year and a half later. That was, I think, in the spring of 69, after, I guess, your senior year of football. And actually, I think it was the early summer, perhaps even after you graduated, you and your dad went up to La Crosse to talk to students up there. So that statement was well after.
Okay, because I graduated in the spring of 70.
Oh, okay. So then it was a year before you graduated.
Well, the last football season was 69, but
okay.
I graduated in May of 70.
Okay, that makes sense. Then it was after your last football season, sure.
Yeah, all right. Since I made that statement then, probably nothing had been done then because the same coaches were still there.
Mm-hmm.
The players that were behind me were still there. Many of us were, that was their senior year, final year.
Sure.
The 69 season. So anything after that were younger, was a younger group, even though the younger group was a part of it then.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have been as committed, so to speak, because they hadn't been there as long.
Sure.
But I kind of still stand by what I said before. Until we left and, you know, those coaches were gone, probably what I felt like it would get better.
Sure.
Meeting with that major problem was something, you know, they may not have been aware of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have been a shock to them. They needed to kind of hurry up and nip it in the bud before it kind of got any worse.
Mm-hmm.
So they met probably with an open mind and wanted to listen, but probably not really knowing what to do.
Sure, sure.
And listening was probably all they could do then. And now, what were they met with the coaches after that and talk with them to get their side of the story or whatever, I don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
Not even sure.
Sure. I did notice in a bunch of these old articles that Ray Arrington on the track team was the athletic representative on the athletic board, and he often seemed to, with Mel Reddick, be one of the spokesmen for what was going on. Do you remember him having a role in this? Do you remember him being particularly active in helping out?
He was a very vocal person, and he was probably one of the ones that really participated in the boycott or the mm-hmm. the unrest that was going on campus when the National Guard was there and when they had the Black student protest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was somebody that everybody kind of looked up to. He was the 800-meter champion, too, in the Big Ten.
Yeah, I was looking into that yesterday to see how successful he was, and he had a very good athletic career.
Yeah, he did. And Mel Reddick had a good football career, too.
Yeah, and basketball, too.
Right. He played two sports. That was something they had told him he could do when he was a student.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he was good in both of those sports. And he could really catch the ball. He had big hands. He could really catch the ball.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as Ray Arrington, I don't know, I'm pretty sure they listen to him, but as far as they have a lot of power, one student athlete on the athletic board, I'm not sure how much power.
Sure,
But it made for having somebody on the inside that could maybe kind of monitor or actually see what they were doing, what they were going to do, what they weren't going to do. But
sure.
I would say his hands were probably tied a little bit.
Yeah, I imagine.
Kind of like my dad's hands mm-hmm. were tied a little bit. So
mm-hmm.
at least he was there to be able to represent and just kind of see what was going on.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, before we move on to other topics, do you remember other players in the team who were particularly active, particularly vocal, really helped to organize these things? Anyone else stick out in your mind as someone who was an organizer?
Yeah, John Smith.
Sure.
I think John Borders.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can't think of Chuck's first name.
Maybe
Chuck Winfrey.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Not Chuck Winfrey, but what is it?
Carl Winfrey.
Carl Winfrey. And then there was another guy named Ted Jefferson.
Yep.
I can't think of anybody else's name right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Remember anything in particular perhaps one of those players did, or were they just sort of generally more supportive, more organizing, or help to organize things?
Well, I would say all the ones that I named,
mm-hmm.
including Reddick,
sure,
that were kind of organized because we kind of stayed in different places, so that was kind of the pipeline
okay.
that kind of connected everybody. So there were no cell phones, but they had, sure. But we always tried to make sure it was a group thing.
Yep.
So.
No, that makes sense. That sounds like a good strategy. All right, so I guess so your last football season was 69, and then you're on campus for one more year and graduate in 1970, is that correct?
Well, 69, and then the next year, you know, the spring is when I graduate.
Mm-hmm, okay.
It wasn't another whole year.
Okay, sure.
69, 72 years.
Sure, sure, that makes sense. And then you got a job at UW Admissions.
Right.
How did that come about?
Yeah, I was an admissions counselor, and then I learned a lot about the university, mm-hmm. and I didn't know because you have to know that stuff in order to talk with students on the telephone or when they want to come take a tour and follow the tour of the admissions office.
Sure.
So I learned how to read transcripts and do credit transfer. Learned about all different types of foods in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, you kind of commit the memory of what transfers from what university to this one and what doesn't.
Sure.
You learn the qualifications, so sometimes you have to make decisions on people that can kind of borderline.
Sure, sure.
It wasn't that real tough with in-state schools, but you only had to be in a bad graduate class.
Mm-hmm.
But out of state students, so it was a little bit more picky.
Yep, yep.
So we had to, you know, the graduating class and test scores and any other things that they did at school, what kind of organizations they were in, if they participated in athletics or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very interesting experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I learned about a lot of the departments at the school that maybe I didn't necessarily know about. And I met a lot of different people that I didn't know before.
Sure, sure.
Because we had to either refer people to them, or if you happen to know somebody in particular in the study, you might want to ask them about what you think about this student. Yeah, just all kind of things.
Sure, sure.
And I enjoyed doing that. It was a lot of desk work and paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one reason that led me to start playing football again.
Sure.
I tried to sit there all day doing that standard kind of stuff, and I was used to being, you know, active. Even though I still did run or lift or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, you know, I need to do something else. Sitting there all day. I hadn't sitting down like that in a long time.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the admissions job gave you a more perhaps well-rounded sense of the university?
Yeah, it did. And then I also worked with the 5-year program that was there.
Okay.
That admitted minority students.
Mm-hmm.
I handled all of those applications.
Mm-hmm.
Would come through me. And so sometimes I would see an application, and then I would show it to the director of the program. His name was Jim Ball.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that person might qualify to him.
Mm-hmm.
And after I kind of learned what he kind of thought, then we kind of speeded that process up because I knew already what he'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Or what he'd say. So that kind of speeded that process up when I kind of learned exactly what he's looking for.
Sure.
At one point in time, they had a undergraduate committee that kind of oversaw all of the minority programs on campus that were admitted to, whether it was the nursing department, pharmacy department, the regular medicine science.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a chairman of that group for 1 year. And that was 2 years. But it was a long time. Chairman of the undergraduate equal educational opportunities committee or something like that.
That's certainly a mouthful.
Yeah, it made me look really important. I enjoyed that too. And I stayed there for 3 years. And then after I was there, I had an offer to go to River Falls with Carmen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Before I get to River Falls, I'm curious, working with these other departments on campus, nearly 70s, about equal opportunity, affirmative action issues, did you get the sense that most departments were willing to cooperate with you and work with you? Did you get, were some departments more resistant to that? I'm wondering how, just like how people reacted to these new programs that were springing up.
Well, yes, I guess pros and cons on either side, but most people were willing to work,
mm-hmm.
and most people, like I said, Jim Ball was in charge of that program,
mm-hmm.
and he was able to get a lot of professors, a lot of maybe some of that to help the students extra about the classes over and the things that they, so they would have tutoring programs or counselors that were there to help make sure that the students would matriculate through the university.
Sure.
And, you know, in the beginning, it was kind of tough, but as more students came and then there were more services to accommodate them, things got better and better.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I don't think they have that program. I'm not even sure if it still exists.
There are similar programs. It seems to change its name every 5 years, 10 years. They institute a new program along similar lines, trying to target minority students or especially economically disadvantaged students, and it changes its name every so often based on a new study. So they do have similar programs still trying to address some of these issues.
All right. Okay. I know a lot of kids came from Chicago and then a lot of kids from Milwaukee.
Sure.
And then there were a lot that came from a lot of different urban areas around the country.
Mm-hmm. Did you have trouble convincing students from Milwaukee or Chicago to come to Madison?
The ones that they were in the top half of their graduating class, I would say no. There might have been some that didn't think they could function well at such a large university.
Sure.
They might want to go to UWM,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or somewhere like that. Now, there weren't a lot of black students or other minority students on campuses like
exactly
maybe Stevens Point or UW Green Bay or even River Falls where I was.
Sure.
But you know, each one of the state universities was trying to do whatever they could do to get more.
Yep.
More students.
Sure.
And, you know, some prefer a large place and some prefer the smaller place, you know, just like any other student.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, but most people were cooperative.
That's good to hear.
Even the ones that maybe didn't want to be cooperative, it kind of like they had to because it was kind of a, what I want to say, a mandate from the chancellor.
Sure,
sure. Memos or whatever, we're going to do this, where, you know, you're going to have to do it.
Yeah, I guess whether you like it or not on some level.
Right. So, and I'm pretty sure there was some there because there were some white students that kind of resented that.
Sure, sure.
You know, and I can understand that. I guess in my mind, I never was sure, and I don't think the 5-year program had anything to do with if there were too many people or not enough people being able to get in from out of school. I don't think those two things ever conflicted.
Okay.
As far as the percentages were concerned, if you were from out of state and you qualified to get in, I don't ever remember turning down anybody.
Hmm. Interesting.
You know, like that. If you didn't have the grade point average or the ranking in the class, you would go to other parts of your application to see if you had other things that you would offer university.
Sure, sure.
Now, if you were from out of state and you were in the lower quarter of your class, you might kind of, we probably just stopped right there. And since you're one of those, one of the denial letters,
mm-hmm.
But if you were in the least up half of your class, or if you were in the top 10% of your class, most of the time you didn't have that much of a problem unless you really had a low test score.
Sure, sure, that makes sense.
That's what the regular student was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that, that are going to make it through. But they just want to make sure they present the opportunity.
Sure.
And the ones that really tried to challenge themselves, most of them made it through. Now, and they call it a 5-year program, so a person can come in there trying to take 15 to 16 credits.
Mm-hmm.
At the very beginning, knowing that they would be doomed to failure, trying to take too much at one time.
Sure.
Especially now, because if you were trying to give them some remedial type courses at first, like if English was 101, I can't remember all the numbers, but if English was 101,
mm-hmm.
I think we had some courses like that, call them 100 courses that those students could take.
Sure.
To get up to the level of 101, then they go and take 101 and start okay. doing some things like that, it would take you 4.5 or 5 years to get out of there.
Sure, sure. It's good to have that support system, though, built into the program.
Right. So, yeah, because you just brought a bunch of people in and not having enough workers, then that's what will be over in a year or two.
Exactly.
Wouldn't be anybody there to support.
So I wonder, I think it's safe to say some of your experience at UW weren't perhaps everything you'd hoped they would be. Were you ever conflicted about encouraging other minorities to come here based on what you had gone through in the late 60s? Or were you able to sort of separate those things?
Well, I was able to separate it. As far as getting a good education, I thought you got a good education. You may have had to look at a few professors funny or look inside of work.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing sometimes? But overall, I think this experience was good for me. It was probably good for me because both my parents were teachers, so learning was not maybe that's okay deal. It was something that was expected.
Sure.
And for anybody that came from my type of background, then most of the time they were the same way.
Mm-hmm.
There were some students that came and we admitted that didn't have the best grades or didn't have high scores, but you could tell by looking at the transcript or recommendation from people that this person probably would benefit from being at university.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the percentages were, but a lot of those kids made it through too.
Mm-hmm.
They just needed that spark or somebody to give them that one chance or whatever the case may have been. And university wasn't for everybody.
Sure.
Some people came there and just kind of flagged out after the first semester because they weren't used to that much competition. They weren't used to being around that many white people.
Mm-hmm.
And that would freak them out, or they just couldn't get along. And, you know, there was those kind of circumstances. And like I said, there was some fights as far as professors or students that didn't necessarily want you around.
Sure.
Because they had these preconceived ideas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, do you think that was a small number of people on campus in the 60s or 70s? A large number of the white students? How do you think that broke down among some of the white students and faculty on campus?
Well, when I got there, they told me that there were about 200 black students on campus. But we used to wonder, where are they? Because we don't see them. Only thing we see are us. When I say us, I mean the athletes.
Yep, yep.
So I used to wonder about that. And but as more and more students came, you know, you could see.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the students that were there before we got there, a lot of them were in graduate school. That
sure.
was one reason we didn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
So a graduate school person was kind of looked upon as somebody that already made it through 4 years at either the UW or some other school, and they applied to the graduate program there. So
sure.
that kind of a different type of person.
Yeah.
Person was intellectual and they're on the up and up and that kind of stuff.
Not hanging out with undergrads too much.
Right. And as opposed to these kids coming from inner city or people like me coming in, hadn't been around a lot of white people before.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know how to react to them. They didn't know how to react to us. So there was some minor conflict sometime. I know sometimes there might be some conflict in the dorm sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Misunderstandings are concerned. Like I said, a lot of some kids were afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if they saw two or three people walking down the hallway in the dorm or coming to cafeteria, maybe talking loud, listening to music, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Not understanding. Because you could not even be thinking about anybody else. People either care or wonder what you're doing.
Sure.
And I know that sometimes there might be conflicts that took place like that, because there were a lot of kids that had not been exposed to us.
Mm-hmm.
They had the preconceived ideas.
Sure.
And they had the ideas that they had gotten from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see it all over their face.
Sure.
So you know, sometimes there was tension there.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see it on both sides. But back to my experience, I don't think I would trade it. I don't think I'd trade that part.
Sure.
For anything, because it was eye-opening. I learned how to wheel and deal, communicate,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was different. Now, kids that's there now, it's probably a totally, completely different experience. You know, I don't know how much different. I don't know if they still feel alone or lonely, but we would always kind of stay together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because, you were never sure about who was who.
Mm-hmm.
Or what they were thinking.
Sure, sure.
Only time somebody might be walking by themselves or do something, if they were late to class, overslept or something, but they were hungry trying to get there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But anyway.
That's interesting, interesting. I guess one final question before we leave Madison. We always like to ask people who were there in the 70s. So August 1970, of course, is the Sterling Hall bombing. Were you in Madison for that? Do you have any memories of that incident in particular?
Was that Sterling Hall?
What's that?
You said that was Sterling Hall?
Yeah, Sterling Hall, the bombing.
I thought that was the science.
They were targeting Army Math, the Army Math Research Center, which was in Sterling Hall, part of the physics department.
Okay.
Or was just located there. It wasn't part of it.
And okay, that was right next to the hospital, right?
Yep, yep.
Okay, that's the same building. I was thinking it was a different name, but yeah, I was there. I was living off campus, and I heard the boom in the night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I heard it morning, whatever it was, and, you know, I just kind of said, wow, what was that? Not thinking anything else. I didn't know if it was thunder or what. And when I got to campus that morning, all these, you know, policemen and the traffic and people looking, then I found out, you know, what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I said, man, I'm glad we down here for these people are going nuts.
Yep.
And then I began to wonder, did I know any of them? Did I seen them at school before? Or,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. I didn't remember seeing any of them or knowing anybody. But
mm-hmm.
I think I don't know, did they ever find a kid out of there?
They eventually caught three of them. One of them is still unaccounted for.
Okay. All right. But yeah, that was a big deal and a big buzz for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. It's
a long time. It kind of made it a little scary.
Yeah, I did that. So, yeah, did it change the atmosphere on campus, do you think, after that happened? After the bombing?
Remind me again. Now, what year was that?
1970, I believe, August.
Okay, I had trying to figure out how I started working yet. I can't remember if I had started working at the admissions office yet or not.
Yeah, August 24th, 1970 was the Sterling Hall bombing.
I'll say again?
August 24th, 1970.
Okay, I can't remember what date I started working in the admissions office. So I know it was 1970, but I can't remember if I started working in July, August, September, what it was. But I do remember I had to come to campus, but maybe I had started working. So I wasn't a student anymore.
Sure.
So I don't know exactly how all the students feel, but I know a lot of people that worked in those buildings were kind of, you know, a little shaky.
Sure.
Are they trying to get another building? Are they trying to make another protest on this end of the campus? Because admissions office is kind of over 3 or 4 blocks from each other.
Sure.
Something like that. So I know I was a little worried. And so a lot of other people.
Yeah.
I can't remember if they made a statement about who did it. When I say they, the bombers, I can't remember if they put out a statement.
I think some sort of a statement, yeah. Just, I think, vaguely anti-war, anti the specific Army Math Research Center. I don't remember exactly what the statement was, but I think they said something around to that effect.
Did anybody die in that?
There was one researcher in the physics department who was there attending an experiment all night, who ended up being killed in the bombing, the one guy.
Okay, guys, because I'm not sure. They probably thought nobody was going to be in there.
That seems to be what they're hoping for.
Yeah. So I don't know if they detonated and they were outside when it detonated, or I guess it was a remote detonation. I'm not even sure if it was on a timer. I don't know how they did it. But it blew that one part of that building was gone.
Yeah.
That kind of brought everything to a head, because all that stuff was just going on, and then all of a sudden, when people from Texas were calling me, we see your school on the news, and sometimes we look for you, and when all that other stuff was going on, then when the bombing occurred, all kinds of people would call, and are y'all okay? Are y'all right? Yeah, we all okay. So it was just, it was just something. You would have had been there.
Yeah.
To feel the tenses in the air, or understand how everybody was feeling.
Yeah, that's the sense I get from reading some of the history of it. Very interesting, and tragic, of course.
Yeah, exactly right.
So you ended up working at admissions for 3 years, you said?
Yeah, 3 years.
And then River Falls recruited you. I'd be interested to hear about that, how you ended up at River Falls and what your position was there.
I think I mentioned before that the chancellor's name was Field. I can't think of his first name. He came to Madison. I don't know who he had talked to at first, but since I've been working with the 5-year program and being the chairman of the undergraduate committee there, I don't know who gave him my name, but he approached me one day, and we talked, and then he came back again, and we talked, and he offered me the job, and I went up there to take a look, and I accepted, and because they were trying to start something, and they already had some black students and Indian students there. And they'd already gotten a guy that was in charge of the Indian Studies Department, and they needed somebody like me. And we shared buildings. I had an office, and the other guy had an office. I think they were raised last night, and I probably did after a while. But they needed some program with some guidance and direction. They needed somebody to help them with getting support for the students, because there was really no type of program going on, they had been recruiting students, and a lot of the students that were there were athletes.
Sure.
Because the football coach had been recruiting them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess somebody thought, well, you know, if this is going to happen, we need somebody here that's going to try to help make sure they get through here.
Sure.
And so that was me, and I stayed there for 2 or 3 years. I have to look on my resume to find out how long I stayed there. It was 2 or 3 years, and at that time, the football coach was looking for another coach, and that was the first time I started coaching on that level. I coached some, had some friends of mine coached some pee-wee teams around Madison.
Sure.
But never real coaching job. That's where I officially started coaching. So I was director of the minority service office as assistant football coach. And I was in charge of the quarterbacks and receivers. And my last year, we won the conference championship. It was a 2-way tie. And we had a real good football team, too. I was pleasantly surprised. And there was some good athletes there. They weren't the kind you're going to find in Oklahoma.
Sure.
The Blacksville or even at Wisconsin. But they were good athletes, and most of them were good kids. They knew this was an opportunity for them. There was some that brought the roots with them, and some that didn't. and so I had to deal with all kind of, I was kind of doing like what Jim Martin had done. If the students in the dorm, I'd get a call, I'd get up at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was, go find out what's going on, what the students is.
Sure.
Or if somebody had to run in with the police or something like that, I'd have to go and try to see what was going on there. Sometimes some of the kids would call me, new so-and-so in jail. We need to try to get him out. What? So those are unwritten, what I was going to say, things
sure.
that you have to do when you're directing a program in the boondocks. Because that's exactly where we were.
So what was it like being in River Falls after being in Waco and then Madison?
Well, River Falls was a lot of the people there were, some of them were really redneck, and you wouldn't think so, but they were. And I guess in Madison, people had started to kind of get used to it. Plus, in Madison, when I got there, supposedly there were about 1,000 blacks that were in Madison. At the end of my 4 years there, there were more there, because a lot of students that were graduating, or some of their families had moved there, or people that had moved in, and as a result, people, when they did graduate, even if they didn't graduate, they would stay there and get a job and just stay. They wouldn't go back home because it was better to stay in Madison than to go back to where they were living before. In River Falls, there were even less. In fact, I think there was one black family in River Falls when I got there. And I asked that guy, I can't remember his name, but how did you get here? How did you get here? What are you doing here? I think he had been in the armed services.
Okay.
And for some reason, I cannot remember why he told me how he got there, but he was there and he liked it, and so he stayed because he had a wife, he had some kids, and they were just there, and right now, and I haven't been back there since I left, so I don't know if any of those kids that were there, I don't know if anybody stayed or not. The ones that were there when I was there, I'm pretty sure most of them went back home because there was absolutely nothing in River Falls, Nothing to do.
I've never been there, so I'll have to take your word for it.
Well, it's not a place you really want to go. You pass through. Because it's off the highway. Whatever the highway is from Madison to St. Paul, Minneapolis. I've forgotten the number.
94, I think.
Yeah, okay. It's off of 94. It's about 10 miles off of 94.
Sure.
So you've got to be going there to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mess you're not going to pass through. But and when they had a little main street there, and they had their little bars and shops and stuff like that. And the students would go out there on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, whatever, have their little fun. If you wanted to, every now and then they'd have maybe a dance in the student center, and the black kids would join in there, or. In my house, I had a basement, and I'd give them parties. I had to just give them something to get away from.
Sure.
And most of them were athletes. There were some females there too. So anybody that was on campus would go to the basketball games, would go to the football games, things like that. If someone was fortunate enough to have a car, they would drive to St. Paul, Minneapolis.
Sure.
And in groups to go out to a club or just to go there after the movie or something like that. Now, they had one movie in the fall, but you didn't have a lot of stuff to look at.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be in a bigger city. So a lot of times when people would go away for the summer or go away for the Christmas holidays, Easter holidays, they would all be anxious to go, and most all of them left. And when they come back, they bring back the new music or new fashions or whatever, because like I said, that was an isolated place.
Yep.
we didn't know about anything. But.
Sure. So did the... It seems like most of the black students there were athletes. Was there much tension between the rest of the student body, or this early 70s, or do you think people were getting along a little better?
No, they had some problems in the dorm, because there were some kids there that, didn't necessarily like them being there.
Sure.
Were jealous, upset, mad, whatever. But for the most part, it was nothing like what had happened in Madison.
Okay.
That wasn't the kind of stuff. And the coach there was real sensitive about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He had coached in, I want to say Racine, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
He had been around black players before. And he recruited a lot of those guys that were there from Philadelphia, and Chicago, and most of them liked it. So there were a lot of problems as far as things that went on in Madison. And I guess he wanted me to be there to make sure that there was something going on, he would know, or I would be able to solve the problem, something like that. You know, I knew there was one week they wanted me there.
Sure.
Just in case. But,
you remember the name of the coach?
Huh?
You remember the name of this coach?
His name is Mike Farney.
Okay, that's always good to have on the record.
Yeah. And, I liked him. He liked running the wishbone. And so that was my first indoctrination to the wishbone, because that's mainly running off there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have trouble with my receiver. Oh, coach, let me go with the ball. So you just be ready. And most of the touchdowns that they called were long touchdown passes, so people trying to come up with a run, and they would always be open.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out well. And I had the quarterback I had there, he was really good. I probably could have played not in Wisconsin, not in Oklahoma, but he probably could have played at a high level.
Sure.
Because he could throw the football and he was a tag, but he had real quick feet.
Mm-hmm.
He was smart, too. So, and we had a couple of running backs there that were really decent.
Mm-hmm.
But because of, I guess, where they played in Philadelphia, not a lot of people wore them. They took the opportunity to come with somebody that wanted to play, and they said, good football player.
Sure. It's always nice to get an opportunity and be wanted.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Like I said, that was my first coaching experience. So when you start coaching, you find out how much you don't know about football.
Yep.
Until you start coaching. But now you're not just looking at the position you play, you have to look at the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I had learned. Even though I knew what I knew, I still didn't know as much as I thought I did. You know?
Sure.
And, because I had to do the defense back a while, and I had to do offense and defense, so I had to learn both sides of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then you learn about decision making and things of that nature, and getting the practice organized, getting game day organized,
sure,
the game plan, and all that kind of stuff. So,
because
when you're in college, you're not involved, at least we weren't involved that much in making a game plan. The coaches did, they presented it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm learning how to make a game plan and learn how to scout and watch him in a different light than being a player.
Sure.
So that was a good experience for me, and he was a good teacher, and I enjoyed working with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole staff was there. Cause one of the guys on the staff was an insurance salesman. so he was a line coach. And it was a funny group of people, and we all went well together. And I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. And then where'd you go after River Falls?
Now, as a result of being there and running the wishbone, I got he had become friends with one or two coaches at Oklahoma because he had gone to their camps that they have, so he had more about the wishbone. And as a result, he got them to come there, I can't think, it was either one or two summers. And that's how I met the Oklahoma coaches. And because they were coming after our wishbone camp that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And Wendell Moser, he was a black coach in Oklahoma that was in charge of the running backs. He had coached, what is his name? Joe Washington and Pruitt and all those All American backs that they had.
Mm-hmm.
He got the head coaching job at Texas Southern.
Okay.
Working in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result of me working with them, they recommended me to him when he took his coaching job in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I got out of the snow and cold back south. Was because it's not what you know a lot of times, who you know.
Yeah, that's often the case.
Yep. And so that's, after I left there, I went to Pete Texas Southern. And I was in charge of the running back there.
Mm-hmm.
And those were a little bit better athletes than what we had at River Falls. And they could do a lot more and a lot of that speed, because Texas Southern was known for their speed and track.
Mm-hmm.
And on the football field.
Mm-hmm.
And because they had won the SWAT a lot of times, especially in track, and some of those guys played football.
Sure.
So they were on a dual thing. They were running track and playing football.
Mm-hmm.
So the track coach there and the football coaches that worked, hand in hand. They didn't mind. He did, track coach didn't mind sharing.
Sure. That's a smart way to do it, too.
Yeah, right. And, like I said, the guy there was Wendell Moser. He was the head coach of Texas Southern. He allowed me to, I guess, expand what I already knew try things I wanted to try, but he always made sure you told him why you were doing what. Give me an explanation of why, what you're doing, why you're doing it, why you think that'll work, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So, like I said, I learned more there as I was progressing in my coaching years. And that was the first time TSU had hired somebody like him from a well-known university or anything, and he had been successful there. In Houston at one of the high schools, so everybody knew it. They knew who we were. And, you know, he and I didn't know each other. He just, the line coach from Oklahoma, the one that recommended me to him. And he kind of just, took the guy's word and I went down there for an interview, and I would say after the interview, said, well, I'm going to tell you this much, and I want you to come. I was kind of like stunned a little bit, but I didn't think it would be that quick.
Must have been a good interview.
Yeah. So I had to come back. Go back to River Falls and back up and give him a notice and tell him I was leaving because he wanted me to come right then. I've always hated that part, that I had to leave so quick.
Sure.
You know, and a lot of students will say, oh, man, you got to go now. I said, yeah, I have to go now. And so the university was nice about releasing me, about not making a big stink out of it, because they knew that was a move up to me.
Sure.
No, so, no problem. I had a lot of fun at Southern, but didn't have to They were trying something they hadn't tried before. They were going to try to have a bunch of coaches. And you get a school like that, you have to teach a class or two.
Sure.
And so we didn't have to teach any classes. But that's where they made a mistake on that. They didn't have enough revenue coming in.
Okay.
But after 2 years, the world was that I didn't have a master's yet, because you have to have a master's to teach. I didn't have a master's yet, so there were three of them that didn't have masters. So, and then I think it was a fourth guy, in order to remain within their budget, they had to let us go. So I ended up going to a high school there.
Okay.
It wasn't hard to find another job. I ended up going to a high school there. And then when I started working on my master's at River Falls.
Okay.
And completed there. I only had about two of the courses.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went back to Texas Southern the second time. Part of my deal with them was I want to make sure I go to class so
sure.
I can get my master's. And I want to be doing something else along with the coaching. So if this happens again, I won't be up out in the cold. So with my background that I had in the admissions office and being the director of the Learning Services Office in River Falls, they made me assistant dean of students.
Oh, wow. Well.
And so I was in the master's, I was just in the students, I was coaching, so I was kind of a busy guy.
Yeah, sounds like it.
So I completed that, and completed the master's part, and that was one down, so I could concentrate on coaching and being in the dean of students office. And that worked really well, because it helped keep some of our football players out of trouble. Same dude saying to come see me if something was going on.
Yep.
And you didn't want to do that because I had the power to keep him from doing activities.
Mm-hmm.
Give him restrictions. There's all kind of stuff. And I had the power to have hearing to put people out of school or suspend, whatever the case may be. And nobody wants to go to the dean's office.
Sure, especially when it's your coach.
Right. So that really helped. And our offices were right there in the financial aid office with the counselor's office. So as a result, I was able to meet a lot of people and get to be friends with a lot of people. But any of the students got in trouble, say, academically, they needed help, I was kind of like, I knew who to send them to. I know what to do. So that being at all this really helped our football program. So, of course, the academic part was concerned as far as registering and getting classes that they needed. Because every athlete needs to have the morning classes because you get to practice in the afternoon. So that helped when you become friends with people who are registered or doing the class deal. Because they don't, they didn't have a, there wasn't the, I don't know how people registered today, but back then, you know, you didn't have the computers where you could get easy registration. This was, you know,
Mm-hmm.
We beat some really good teams. We lost the first game of the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
A game that we should have won. We had two fumbles from two guys that never fumbled.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. And that's what got we lost. The game was 28-20. I think it was the score was. And one newspaper reporter that was at the game said, "Coach, he said, I never thought I'd see this. I never thought I'd see Pauley go to the playoffs again."
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was all excited about that. But like I said, we had started winning. And the year before that happened, we hadn't won a game.
Hmm.
We had lost those other guys from 2 years ago.
Sure.
We won a game. And then anybody expects us to do anything, and all of a sudden, it kicked in. And those guys threw up, and like I said, they all stayed together.
Mm-hmm.
Because as freshmen, they won all their games, I think, except for one. So that would be me, because that was going to be a good group if we could keep them together. And we did, and it was hard because the community that we were in was kind of a transient community,
mm-hmm.
and everybody was trying to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And drug infested gangs that started coming in and all that kind of stuff. And it was just hard to keep them together. A lot of times you might not know who's going to be on your team the next year.
Sure.
Who might be leaving because the parents are trying to get out of there. You might have to leave and move it in, but most of the parents are trying to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But that nucleus is that youth they're staying. And, you know, it turned out to be a really, really good experience. At that time, I got the coach of the year for that particular season.
Mm-hmm.
And, when you win in that, caused a lot of problems. people become your new best friend. The one that talked about you the year before.
Yep, that's often how it works.
Yep, that's right. But as a coach, though, you kind of learn how to let that stuff just roll off your back.
Yep.
Because you know how people are. So I don't even let it bother. But like I said, that was a good experience.
How long did you stay coaching there?
I started there in 85.
Okay.
Yeah, 85. And I stopped there in, I think it was 93.
And were you teaching also?
Yeah.
What were you teaching?
At that school, you have to teach. I taught health.
Okay.
So I got a chance. And that's one good thing about, being in high school. You have to teach physical education or health.
Sure.
You get a chance to see everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that not on the football field, you get just them in the PE class and say, "Hey, why don't you come with me?" And because I thought some of the other senior coaches started physical education class, I taught health.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught ninth grade health, and everybody where our system was set up, all freshmen had to take health. And nobody would get by.
Mm-hmm.
You see people there. And I like being in the classroom because it gave me an idea of how they thought, what kind of workers they were.
Sure.
It was amazing. I could see how they were in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we developed a real good relationship with all the teachers, and they would help us out as much as possible. We were doing the no pass, no play thing before they made it official. Because we were doing that in the other high schools in Houston too. In fact, coaches have been doing that before they made that thing an official state rule. So we didn't want anybody that wasn't going to pass and wasn't doing that work.
Sure.
To play. So that's been going on a long time. And I guess one reason I really that was a big thing for me because I would have a pity session sometimes before practice. Then you have an athletic period at the end of the school day, so you can get some extra practice in or extra board work or whatever. A lot of times we'd have a study hall, and any teachers that were at planning period or sometimes they would come and help us out. Some of the guys that weren't doing their thing, or you gotta let them do their homework before we practice to make sure they did it. Because I know a lot of them have to do it when they get home and they're tired, they won't do anything. So we try to make sure they did as much as they could before it was time to practice and go home.
Sure.
Let me see what else here. That's mainly. Hey, I retired in 94. I was working at an elementary school. I started my DJ business.
Okay.
And in 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still teaching there. I went to elementary school. So I'd have more time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just did that. And in 94, I retired. I was able to do that.
And how'd you get into that business?
Huh?
How'd you get into the DJ business?
Well, I like music, and my son likes music.
Mm-hmm.
And all during my time as a teacher, whenever the teachers wanted to just get another party, I'd always play the music. And sometimes I would disconnect my stereo from my home and take it to the clubhouse where we were having something, pick it up, and play the music. Well, I was doing all that stuff for nothing.
Okay.
At night. And once my son DJed a party for a friend of his, and the mother gave him $10. And then it happened again. And then the light came on in my head and said, you know what? I like music, you like music, we can probably make us some money doing this.
There you go.
So I sold a lot of my home stereo stuff, traded it to get professional equipment.
Mm-hmm.
When you move your home stuff around, you got to disconnect all the time, then you mix something, and the stuff is not made out of real wood, you get this and stuff all in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I stole that, went and bought some professional equipment. This is kind of a small set. And we just went from there. So now we can do anywhere from a small group to 1,000 people. And we play all different kinds of music. I've got big band music, 50s, 60s music, 70s, 80s music, 90s music, rap, country. Hispanic music, it's whatever the client wants.
Sure.
I can do it. And we do a lot of wedding receptions. We do high school dances, proms, homecoming dances.
Sure.
Middle school dances, stuff like that. Do company parties, corporate parties, Christmas stuff, banquets, or whatever, anything that requires a microphone.
Sure.
So
do you have a favorite type of music?
Whatever is paying me, paying me to play whatever, that's my favorite type of music.
There you go. That's a very sensible answer.
Now, my son had to learn how to appreciate every type of music. You know, he's into the rap and the hip-hop at the time we got started. And I told him about that now. He didn't like to listen to country music and his own music. They don't pay a lot more money.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to listen to hip hop. But he finally understood that. He understands that now. So, and I probably have grown to have an appreciation for country music because, been in country, a lot of people like country music. So, you have to learn how to play that and appreciate it.
Sure.
Even if it's something I don't like, they would never know it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So do you ever make it back up to Wisconsin very often?
I haven't been this year, but I usually come go once or twice a year. And if I don't, that means my parents came here.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't go this year. I may come for Christmas. I'm not sure yet.
Mm-hmm.
So will you guys be there when if I do come?
No, I think we'll be here. Certainly always interesting to see people. We'd love to get together. I think Troy will be in touch after these interviews for paperwork and stuff, but we could do that for the mail. But certainly we always love seeing the people we've been talking to. Put a face and a body to the voice.
Yeah.
So anything else? We sort of have a whirlwind tour of your life over these three interviews. Anything? Any sort of wrap-up comments, anything else you want to get in the record, anything you think we've missed so far?
Well something that I do that I've always wanted to do is I do a lot of volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And I volunteer at the elementary school where I last work.
Okay.
I go over there two or three times a week, sometimes more, and help kids with their studies, with their behavior. Sometimes I map out a plan with the parents.
Mm-hmm.
I give teachers relief. You know, sometimes there's some kids that just get on their last nerve. I'll take them outside and I always talk to them. I'll take them and we'll do some type of behavior type exercise talk to what the problem is. You know, things that make you, you know, if you got some kids like to fight, some kids just like that, they're nuts.
Sure.
They can't have more attention. So I do a lot of that. And I work in the summertime with the kids sometimes. I know I did this past summer, a community recreation program. And then sometimes if something like the boys club or whatever wants to have a party or dance, I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
If I really know the person, I don't charge them anything. Sometimes they have a budget to do stuff. It won't be that much sometimes, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I do that for them because most of the time, if you do something like that, somebody else will see you as a paying customer.
Sure.
Doesn't want you anyway. So I do a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I play music a lot of times for the seniors. The senior citizens at the YMCA, they have these senior programs for seniors at YMCAs and retirement homes, things like that. I do that. That's mostly it. I kind of do what I want to do, what I can really do, so as long as I want to do it.
That's good to be in a point in your life when you can do that.
Yeah, you're right. And I like to be game because you can have fun and get paid at the same time.
Yep.
And I've got a lot of DJ friends. If I'm overbooked, I can call them. If they get overbooked, they call me. Sometimes we do some things together. But, you know, it's been pretty good to be able to do it full time, not to worry about, you know, anything else.
Sure.
But most of the time now, though, I do a lot of volunteer, like I said.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And I really enjoy that because I may be able to do some things teachers can't do. But, you know, teachers have the power these days. Students have more rights than the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a chance to actually talk to parents and be open and honest with them and tell them the truth. I don't have to worry about what I say. I don't have to worry about the, I don't know what word I'm looking for, but about being nice all the time.
Exactly.
So, anyway, that's basically it, unless you know, if you have some other questions. I can't think of anything else right now. If I do, I can always call you and add some.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure there are a lot of things that I have forgotten about that I may remember later on or something. I don't know.
Sure, and I'll go over this and see if we have any follow-up questions, and we can certainly schedule more interviews in the future. But I think for now, this concludes the third interview with Lewis Richardson, and thanks a lot for your time, Lewis.
All right, thank you.